supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, these days in the mental health field, community service providers are embracing something called a recovery-oriented movement. Simply put, it means going beyond treating symptoms to treating people, focusing on quality of life. It represents a dramatic shift since I was practicing in the field some 40 years ago, where people with mental illnesses spent their lives languishing in mental hospitals, and expectations for their lives or quality of lives were pretty low. This recovery-based approach, however, raises many questions. Different people understand it in different ways. It's questions about empowering people with mental illness and the ethics and accuracy of that. And others are saying perhaps this field is moving just too fast. Well, joining me to discuss recovery and all the other questions are Arthur Evans. He's director of Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health and Retardation Services and has been for the last 5 years. Dr. Arthur Evans, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And Mark Salzer is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, principal investigator and director of the Collaborative on Community Integration. Mark Salzer, welcome back.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me again.
And on the telephone is Dr. Harold Schwartz, psychiatrist in chief and vice president of behavioral health for the Institute of Living up in Connecticut. Dr. Schwartz, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
If you've been through the mental health system or are in it now, give us a call. We're at 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Mark Salzer, I'd like to start with you. I did a good deal of research for this show, and the more I read, the more definitions of recovery I have found. So you're giving me a nod as though you're not surprised. So what is it?
Yeah, I'm not surprised at all. I actually went to a presentation a couple of years ago where a nationally known person in the field was talking about having woken up that morning with a new definition of recovery. So it's not unusual at all. Every state has a different definition. The federal government has a different definition. Pennsylvania has a definition. We have a definition here in Philadelphia, the surrounding counties. The definition I like of recovery is one that a leading researcher in the area named Bill Anthony gave a number of years ago now. Recovery means living a satisfying and fulfilling life in the community with or without the presence of mental illness symptoms.
So that makes sense, pretty simple and straightforward. But I would imagine living a satisfying life in the community is pretty hard to do if you're confused or hallucinating or severely depressed or having impulses to hurt yourself or someone else.
Right. Obviously, there are challenges associated with having a serious mental illness and experiencing these symptoms. But what we've seen in the research is that there are many, many individuals who, even when they have symptoms of their illness, even when there are delusions, there are hallucinations, there is depression, there is mania, that people, many people are working or able to work, going to school or are able to go to school, have relationships or are able to have relationships, vote, be parents, work out at gyms, anything that anybody else does. We have evidence indicating that even with the presence of symptoms, people are able to live satisfying lives.
Harold Schwartz, I come at this just as a clinician, just as a psychotherapist, and you know, I'm listening to Mark, and I'm thinking, in order to live a satisfying life with symptoms like that, one must have a different relationship with their own mind. They have to understand their own mind differently rather than just living inside of it.
Well, that's an interesting observation. I think that recovery movement is based on the promotion of autonomy, and if you think about what autonomy means and what autonomous decision making means, and clearly the brain mind is the organ affected by mental illness, and autonomous decision making by definition has to be affected. So we know that people with severe mental illness do have ways of thinking, often that are different than ours. But I think, nevertheless, the movement to adjust to living in the community with a different way of being is reflective of that. It's honoring of the individual's autonomy. The problem arises often when individuals just are not capable and competent of the kind of autonomous decision making that would be ideal in the promotion of their well-being in the community.
You've called yourself a recovering paternalist.
Yes.
So what's the difference between recovery movement and traditional medical model?
Well, I think the traditional medical model in terms of treatment of mental disorder going back to the Enlightenment has been dictated by coercive treatment practices, and we've had a lot to learn over the last 20 or 25 years, especially about how ineffective that may be at times. At the same time, the promotion of autonomy at times comes right up against those critical moments when some degree of persuasion or coercion may be necessary to treat patients. I would cite as an example, if individual choice and the promotion of choice is at the core of the recovery movement, that's often played out and on the medical end of the whole continuum of care. It's played out around the taking of medications and the degree to which individuals ought to have choice, including the choice to refuse.
So that's a big deal.
That is a very
it's
big
a
deal.
Yeah.
Yes, and the evidence indicates that the duration of untreated psychosis is critical to recovery.
And we know, or I knew, I don't know if it's still the case, that Medicare won't pay for someone who's not taking their medication.
Well, Medicare may not pay, and hospitals, Medicaid and hospitals may be left with patients under their care who refuse medication with no way to advance their treatment. It's an enormous problem, but the biggest problem is for the individual and really for the promotion of recovery. It's absolutely critical to limit the length of periods of psychosis, especially the first episode of psychosis,
right.
The episodes that follow thereon.
Arthur, I'd like you to weigh in. You've talked a great deal about this recovery movement, and you said it's got implications about the way we think about, look at people with mental illness. How so? What's it done to the lens?
Well, I think it has really forced us as a field to step back and to look at what we do, why we do it, how we do it. When I was trained, which was back in the 80s, and I don't think training of psychologists and psychiatrists and social workers has changed a lot, we were essentially taught that if you have a serious mental illness, you had it for life, that you really wouldn't get a lot better, that you know, it was essentially a death sentence. And we set up institutions that were based on that notion. So if you look at any state in the country, you have large campuses where we warehouse people for many years. I think while we have looked at how do we help people come back to the community, we really haven't challenged the underlying assumptions of the disease, of the disorders that people have, and we certainly haven't changed how we practice our profession. And so, you know, one of the things that we know from the literature is that people recover from mental illness at a much higher rate than we thought, and certainly that we were trained. Work by Courtney Harding and work that has been and later replicated by the World Health Organization shows that two-thirds of the people who have even very serious mental illnesses can function fairly well and independently in the community. There's another third of the folks where our technologies and our advances in service delivery haven't advanced to the point where we can help them to the degree that we would like. But even for that group, we can change and shift how we provide services and provide them in a way that focuses on dignity and respect, we give people the best shot of recovering to the extent that they can.
Well, all right. I want to concretize this a bit and use your reputation to help launch the question. I don't want to scare you here. But your reputation is that since you've taken over 5 years ago, you have transformed the mental health system in the city of Philadelphia from one that arguably was more medical, paternalistic, that's now more recovery-oriented. Mm-hmm. But what does that look like concretely? Okay. What does it look like to a family?
Well, I think it looks like several things. One of them is that we have radically changed what the expectations are for treatment. We are focusing on outcomes that matter to people. Historically, let me give you a very concrete example. It's a story I like to tell of a woman, actually when I was in Connecticut, who had an adult son who had schizophrenia, had been released from the hospital, was literally living in her basement, smoked cigarettes, drank coffee all day. That was his life. And she said, I want more for my son. Now, in a traditional system, his case, his situation would have been reviewed as a success. He was not in jail. That's successful. He was not being rehospitalized. He was not getting into trouble, quote unquote. And so from every indicator that we have as a system, he would have been viewed. But if you ask him, and if you ask his family, was that the life that he wanted? It was absolutely not, and he wanted more. And so recovery and having a recovery orientation is about moving beyond symptom management. And the way we see it is symptom management is necessary but not sufficient, that people want more, and that part of our goal as a treatment system is to help people to reach what their individual aspirations are for two reasons. One is that that's what any of us would want if we were stricken with a mental disorder. But secondly, from a steward of public resources, we know that that is a much more effective way of working with
people.
All right,
so I want to come back to that case. So in the old days, he'd be in the basement. He may or may not be taking medication. He may or may not be visited mm-hmm. by a social worker. He may mm-hmm. or may not be in some kind of outpatient
right.
or
right.
daycare.
Right.
Tell me about today. Tell me about
well, today,
him and his mother today.
A good example, we radically transformed our day treatment programs, which were essentially programs where people who had been institutionalized came back to the community. They lived in community residence, residences. They would go to these programs on a daily basis, literally picked up by a van, taken to the program, and then taken back home at the end of the day, literally for years.
Babysitters.
Well, yeah, you could say that. We felt that to really move those programs to a recovery orientation meant really changing the role of providers. So the providers saw themselves as coaches, as facilitators, certainly as treaters as well, because symptom management and dealing with people's symptomatology is a part of it. But again, we don't think that that's sufficient. Worked with people in learning how to use public transportation, going to the library, getting jobs, those kinds of things. And it's a much more vibrant kind of treatment setting. The clinicians like it a lot more because they feel that they're getting to use the skills that they were trained in. Certainly the people who are in those programs like it a lot more. Certainly we, from a payer standpoint, like it more because we see people getting better. They're getting jobs. They're moving on with their lives. That's what treatment ought to be about. That's what we ought to be focused on. And we think it's short-sighted to only focus on the pathology, the symptoms, but really look at what it is that people want and then design a service system to provide that kind of support.
Well, let me bring up an issue, just to flag. We're going to have to take a break, but I want to flag an issue that we need to talk about when we come back from our break, and that issue is what you're talking about, Arthur, sounds great, but to be effective, you got to change the world, too, for mm-hmm. it to work. And mm-hmm. changing the world's a bit more complicated. So that's one of the many things we're going to talk about with the three of you when you come back. If we're talking about recovery in mental health and going beyond symptom management or symptom diminishment, my guests are Arthur Evans. He's director of Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health and Mental Retardation Services. Do we still say mental retardation services?
Yeah, we're trying to change that to intellectual disabilities.
But, you know, it's government, so it takes a while.
We'll fix that. Mark Salzer is a psychologist, associate professor of psychology at Penn, and principal investigator at the Collaborative on Community Integration. Harold Schwartz is the psychiatrist-in-chief and vice president of behavioral health at the Institute of Living. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. If you've got a loved one that has a mental illness that has been treated or treated unsuccessfully, give us a call, 888-477-9499. If you've got questions about services that are out there or not out there, we'd love to hear from you. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
From the Mainline Health Heart Center, where nationally recognized clinicians offer an array of treatments for cardiovascular disease, including minimally invasive robotic bypass surgery, laser interventional procedures that can stop a heart attack in its tracks, beating heart bypass surgery, and multiple options for the treatment of arrhythmia. The hospitals of the Mainline Health Heart Center, Bryn Mawr, Lankinaw, Paoli, Riddle, and Bryn Mawr Rehab. Information online at mainlinehealth.org.
Would you believe Hanukkah songs by Woody Guthrie? Yep, that's right. Recently discovered holiday lyrics by America's legendary balladeer and music by the Klezmatics. Celebrate Hanukkah with Woody Guthrie, the Klezmatics, and me, Murray Horwitz. It's a happy, joyous Hanukkah from NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about recovery in mental health, moving from just working with symptoms or illnesses per se to working with people and their lives and our communities. My guests are Hal Schwartz, who joins us by phone, psychiatrist-in-chief at the Institute of Living in Connecticut. Mark Salzer is a psychologist, associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a principal investigator at the Collaborative on Community Integration. And Arthur Evans, he's a director of Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health and mental retardation services. He has been there for the last 5 years. I'd like us all to listen to something. Our producer, Mike and Scott, visited a program called The Wedge. It's a medical center in South Philly where recovery-based mental health services are provided. In this clip, excuse me, she speaks with Robert Martin, who's a lead certified peer specialist. He's been in recovery for a little over 7 years now, and he's been a peer specialist since 2007. But before he got into treatment for mental illness, Robert was homeless, addicted to drugs, and turning to crime to support his habits. Let's listen.
Well, if you want to know really who I am, my mother and my father were not in my life. They both were heavily into selling drugs and doing drugs. So basically, I was an abandoned child, but I did have the love of my sister. I like to think I'm very well educated because I went to school, I enjoyed school, I did well in school, but due to the abandonment issues, I had my own issues, and I think I became an introvert and sunk inside myself and didn't really explore and talk to people about who I was and what I was feeling. So with all those feelings bottled up, I turned to drugs at a very early age. Then I went to my first inpatient program. I started to get an understanding of what recovery was, but I still wasn't ready. So I went out and got beat up in the world some more, meaning I turned to a life of crime. I lived out on the streets for many, many years. You know, I have this saying, my home used to be on 13th and Locust. I used to panhandle down there. It was a very, very rough life. You know, that's why I'm so into helping people, because I can understand about being in the trenches and not being able to dig your own self out. But if you have that helping hand, somebody else, a glimmer of hope, that's what can help bring you into the light.
And what do you think is different about the approach of recovery?
People started really dealing with people not necessarily through treatment. When people used to deal with me through treatment, they used to deal with my symptoms, with the diagnosis. They didn't deal with Robert Martin, the human being. And that has been the most profound difference now, because I understand the people that are around me. They deal with me as Robert Martin, not Mr. Bipolar or Mr. Schizophrenia or Mr. Substance Abuse. You know, I'm not a diagnosis.
What do you think in your work, being a peer specialist, what are the most important things that you want to do for other people in helping them through the dark times?
I think the one thing I really want to do for people is to help them to see that the grass is greener on the other side if they can just stick through the darkness, through the trials and the tribulations. Because when you're sitting in the darkness, you don't see the other side. You don't pay attention to it. You've literally given up on it. And I think the job I do, I don't really teach people. I support people. People come to me and tell me their dreams and their aspirations and what they want to get back in life. And I support them with that. I walk alongside of them. I don't walk in front of them. I don't walk behind them. We walk hand in hand, which makes a tremendous difference when you're dealing with a human being.
That was Robert Martin, who is at a program called The Wedge. It's a medical center in South Philly that uses a recovery-based approach. And he talked about his journey from the street to becoming a peer counselor. He was speaking with our executive producer, Mike and Scott. So when we opened the show, Mark, we asked you to define the recovery movement, and nothing personal, but I think Robert Martin did a way better job. Nothing personal.
I agree. Robert, I actually know Robert. Robert is recovery. And I'd like to say, too, there are lots of Roberts out there and lots of Sues and lots of everyone else out there who are evidence of recovery themselves rather than my fancy academic definitions.
It's a great story. Harold, I want to turn to you. When I was listening to Robert Martin, I realized, you know, he was talking about substance abuse. And substance abuse has always been thought of as recovery. It's, you know, you joked about a recovering paternalist, but substance abuse has always been in that category. It's something you live with and trying to find a good life living with a chronic condition. And lately, I'm hearing eating disorders are starting to fall in that category. It's not something you get cured of. It's something you live with.
Well, I think that Mr. Martin is an incredibly articulate advocate for recovery at its best, and he really does highlight the importance of the focus on the entire individual and the individual's entire life. It's true that the concept of recovery historically has flowed out of the substance abuse community, in which there's been both an acknowledgement that the risk for recidivism with regard to substance use is so great that it's best to think not in terms of cure, but in terms of staying on a pathway toward a better life. And there clearly are many advantages that concept has brought, into mental health services and the continuum of mental health services. It's an interesting concept to think that eating disorders and other psychiatric disorders should be thought of in the same way. I'm not sure that a 50 or 60 year old woman, let's say 30 years down the road from an eating disorder in late adolescence, but well beyond it, would choose or prefer to think of having an eating disorder in recovery for life, or prefer a medical model which sees the eating disorder as an illness at a point in time from which one did actually finally and fully recover. This gets to the definition as to whether recovery is a process or can be thought of as in a more singular way for certain kinds of illnesses.
Yeah, well,
time will tell.
It's not just the illness, it's the people that carry them. It's so many, many factors, you know, whether you got it and have to live with it or whether you can get over it.
I mean, it is truly multifaceted, and in fact, we still don't understand enough about the causes of these illnesses, and in fact it presents a challenge even to the definition not only of recovery, but the definition of illness itself.
I've got a quick question of you. It's a bit of a tangent, but you know, you're a psychiatrist in chief for a hospital based program and an advocate for recovery. I mean, by definition, hospitals are paternalistic, and that paternalism gets reinforced by Medicare, Medicaid, HIPAA, malpractice lawyers.
It's absolutely true, and it's a kind of contradictory professional life to have to live. You know, on the one hand, I am increasingly aware, as I am now into the 30th year of my career, of the degrees to which hospitals can be coercive and paternalistic. And as we struggle to adopt many elements of the recovery movement, we're stopped in our tracks by reimbursement issues and by regulatory issues. I mean, recently, we've seen a rash of regulatory decisions with regard to safety, and safety is a huge issue in hospitals, that are leading us to strip the dignity out of the environment of our inpatient units for the sake of safety, so that if a person could potentially harm themselves on vanity drawers, in a bathroom, well, the vanity drawers have to be stripped out. If right now hospitals around the country are looking at the issue of bathroom doors, doors to bathrooms that may be inside patients' rooms and therefore outside of the view of staff, but could potentially be a site for hanging. And one of the choices we're faced with is the possibility of removing the doors.
I was hospitalized for a medical problem, and I had a temp of 100, and my normal temp runs around 97. And the nurse, which so 100 for me is, you know, a temp. So, you know, the nurse said, we can't give you any Tylenol, Scott, because we want to take care of your liver. So the rule is 101. We won't give you Tylenol. So I said, you know, do you treat numbers or do you treat patients? And, you know, governing bodies would have us treat numbers and drawers and closets and things like that. We've got a long way to go, and they have a long way to go also. I've been hogging the three of you for a very long time. There's a lot of people who want to join the conversation. So let's go right to the phones. We've got Nick on the line. Nick, hi. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I worked for a while in a manufacturing plant in Binghamton, New York, and it was set up specifically for people with mental illnesses to give them employment. And I'm wondering how the empowerment of those people through showing them that they can be active participants in society plays into the recovery. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Well, we can. I'm gonna turn it to two of my guests with that. First of all, you can answer that, Mark, but I want to turn to you, Arthur, and find out how that's done. You know, how an employer does that. So you want to address, Mark, what's
Sure, I can address it. I mean, it sounds like you were involved in either a sheltered workshop or a transitional employment setting where, you know, you had slots maybe for individuals in recovery, people with mental illnesses to work at that setting. And these are certainly wonderful programs in the sense that they highlight the importance of employment in people's lives. What I like about Robert's story and the conversation today is recovery is about people's whole lives, not just their symptoms. And also, recovery isn't the antithesis of illness, too. It's not lack of illness. It's, look, you might have these symptoms, you might have them for the rest of your life, but you can still do things. And we have ample evidence that people with serious mental illnesses want to work. People want to work. It's important in their lives, just like it's important in everybody's lives, and it decreases poverty. And poverty is one of the biggest issues that that these individuals
face.
Well,
we also heard from Robert another very human thing, and that is he wants to give back. And there's healing in giving back no matter what the issue, and that's universally human. I want to turn to you, Arthur, and find out how do we make employment accessible for those with mental illness?
Well, one of the things we know from the scientific literature is that what works best, Mark mentioned supported or workshops, sheltered workshops. And so traditionally we've thought that the way to help people was to create these artificial environments and to train people in those environments and then send them into sort of the real world. But what the literature shows is that the best way to help people with employment is to get them into a real work setting very quickly and then provide support. And so those supported employment strategies are very effective at helping people to be very successful in a range of work environments. And they have a couple of other real benefits. One of them is that we know that people who are employed are much less likely to be hospitalized, to relapse. And so from a clinical standpoint, helping people to have that kind of support in employment is very important. But there's another thing that I think you kind of alluded to. If you go to a party and you introduce yourself, you know, what comes up within probably the first 5 minutes is, what do you do? It is fundamental to how we see ourselves in this culture, and to the extent that people don't have employment, it really makes it difficult for them to see themselves, and for anyone else, frankly, to see themselves as a real adult in this society.
And we have to address the issue of stigma. I don't know, Harold Schwartz, you can't see me, but I'm a quadriplegic. So when I go to a party, people say to me, "What did you do?" Assuming that, you know,
right.
I can't work. So we've got to address the bigger. Let's take one call before we go to break. We've got Roland on the line, and I want to talk to him. If it's the Roland, I think it is. Roland?
Yes, Dan. How are you?
Yeah, hi, Roland. How are you? You promised to call me, but I didn't think it was going to be here.
I will call you, and I just could not pass up the opportunity while I had you and Arthur and Mark all together to just, you know, reinforce what you guys have been talking about as far as recovery is concerned, and just to enhance the discussion by saying that, you know, it is really looking at the entire behavioral issue. And looking at the number of people who have mental illness that are self-medicating with drugs, and in fact, people who are using drugs who are, in a sense, self-medicating with their mental illness, is very crucial, and the theme of recovery is very, very important to them. And in fact, you know, what I've been able to experience in working with Arthur and in our system transformation is the fact that recovery really is the presence of the strengths that people have in their recovery and, you know, in their struggles. And really focusing in on those strengths is what gets you to, you know, a really clear, you know, discussion of recovery.
Roland, give us your title before we say goodbye.
I'm the director for the Office of Addiction Services.
Yeah, for the city of Philadelphia. And it's good to hear your voice. I have to say with full disclosure that Roland and I work together. I don't even want to tell you how long ago. It was over 30 years ago, and as his nominal supervisor, we challenged each other.
And my mentor, and I got to give you a lot of credit for, you know, a lot of the way I think right now, which may not be so much credit as it is accusation.
Rowan, thanks for your call. It's good hearing you from you again, my friend. Bye-bye. We are talking about recovery in mental health, recovery in behavioral health. My guests are Dr. Arthur Evans. He's a psychologist director of Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health and Mental Retardation for the city. Mark Salzer is a associate professor of psychology at Penn, and he's the principal investigator for the Collaborative on Community Integration. And on the phone is Harold Schwartz, psychiatrist and chief vice president of behavioral health for the Institute for Living in Connecticut. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY FM.
Cooper University Hospital's Neurological Institute supports WHYY and is the only hospital in the Delaware Valley with the Gamma Knife Perfection. This radiosurgery instrument treats brain tumors and brain disorders with 192 precisely targeted beams of gamma radiation. Details about this non-invasive treatment of brain disorders are available at cooperhealth.org/gamma or 1-800-8-COOPER.
On the next Fresh Air, fashion designer turned director Tom Ford talks about adapting the Christopher Isherwood novel A Single Man into a new film.
Beginning to wonder if I was ever going to be able to turn this novel into a film. And he said to me out of the blue, "Make it your own. The novel is the novel. Make this film your own."
Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about recovery in mental health, not just treatment of symptoms, but treatment of people and helping people with mental illness live better lives, more comfortable lives, more productive lives. My guests are Arthur Evans. He's director of Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health and Retardation Services. Mark Salzer, associate professor of psychology at Penn, and he is a principal investigator at their Collaborative on Community Integration. Harold Schwartz is psychiatrist in chief and vice president of behavioral health at the Institute for Living. I want to turn to you, Harold. That with dollars tight, money is being paid more and more for evidence-based outcomes. And in the recovery movement, there's not a whole lot of evidence yet. Or is there?
I think that's one of the issues that the recovery movement is going to have to take on, and that is the issue of evidence-based practice. I mean, throughout the medical system, we are compelled, and I think for good reason, to use evidence-based medicine, evidence-based practice. But one of the critical tenets of recovery is patient choice, which may include choosing a treatment that's not evidence-based, may include choosing a medication that is not the medication that all of our indicators would suggest might be best for the patient, could mean refusing hospitalization when hospitalization might be, surely from the medical and paternalistic view, most appropriate. We're challenged by the evidence-based question.
Arthur?
Well, the way we have conceptualized recovery, both here and in my work in Connecticut from the very beginning, it is with the idea that one of the things that undergirds a really truly recovery-oriented system is that it uses evidence-based practices. It's our view that you really can't help people get better if you're not using what the science tells us works. And so, for example, here in Philadelphia, we're working with Aaron Beck, who is the originator of and creator of cognitive therapy, one of the best and most well-documented psychotherapeutic approach that we have in the field. And Dr. Beck is working with us to infuse cognitive therapy throughout our entire system. It's probably one of the largest evidence-based practice implementations in the country right now. And so I think it's a false dichotomy to say that either you're recovery-oriented or you're evidence-based. And in fact, again, we see it as being integral into how we think about it. And in fact, I would challenge anyone who believes that the current system produces the outcomes that we want and that we can demonstrate that the current service system, the service and practices are getting us the outcomes that we want. And in fact, every single study that has come out, every report that's come out has said that our systems are fragmented, that we're not using the best of treatment approaches, that there are a number of issues. And so what we're really trying to do is look at the science, look at what people tell us they want, and really try to integrate those two things and come up with what we think is the most effective efficient cost.
Yeah, and many argue that today's mental health system is anything but a system.
Well, I challenge that. I think that if you look at what happens in mental health care, our outcomes are as good as any other chronic condition. If you look at treatment outcomes for diabetes or cardiovascular disease, and you look at the treatment outcomes in mental health, they're very comparable. And so, I think that one of the things that frankly has been a challenge is that the mental health system has not been funded and resourced in the same way as a med-surg hospital. They just haven't. I mean, you go into a med-surg hospital, they have all kinds of nice, shiny equipment. You don't see that.
And maybe for the same reason we talked about earlier, back to that stigma thing, which is rippling throughout since the very beginning. I want to try to get a few more calls in while we still have time. We've got Lauren on the line. Lauren, I hope I pronounced your name right.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. It's really nice to hear your discussion. I'm excited to be speaking with you. You've really been inspirational. I just wanted to say that I agree so much with your guest who said that lots of things have to happen to make these recoveries happen. I was diagnosed as bipolar as just a 22-year-old. I had an extreme form of the illness. The way that I was addressed as a patient, I've seen change over the years, over the 16 years, from initially being told by support people that I needed to change my expectations of what my life would be like, and to just accept basically a lower existence than I may have been on a path for. And I really have had a complete recovery, even after being diagnosed with a refractory illness and told that I would never recover or have a normal life. So I think that some of the things that had to happen, as your guest mentioned, were that I had to have dedicated professionals who were willing to help me avoid hospitalization and to use medication in a way that may not have been so accepted or acknowledged at the time. I also was lucky enough to stumble upon some gifted professionals who were really persistent. I've been lucky enough to be in major cities with research facilities to be treated, and I've been lucky enough to be equipped to self-pay over the years for treatment.
You know, in a way, your story is inspirational, and in a way, your story is heartbreaking because of that language you use over and over and over again. I've been lucky enough, and unfortunately, I fear the majority is not lucky enough. And
oh, definitely.
And I listened to your story, and I'm curious about how my other guests will weigh in, but despite all we talk about, and we've learned a great deal, a tremendous amount about mental illness and community integration, certainly over the last 20 years, our knowledge about mental illness is still quite primitive, and we know a whole lot less about mental illness than we'd like to think we know. And you know when you're with a good mental health professional, when they sit down with you and say, I'm not sure, let's see what we can figure out together here, what's going to work best for you.
Right. I also maintain this perfect quality of life due to medication that I don't even think was invented when I was first diagnosed.
Yeah, you are right. Lauren, thanks so much for your call, and I wish you the best. I can't see everybody's faces, but when I talked about the lucky part, I certainly saw the two of you. Arthur, what was your reaction?
Well, I think that's the most exciting part of my job, is which is as a government official, as a payer for these services, that we're actually getting to change. We're trying to change our service system so that the experience that this woman had is the expectation when someone comes into the treatment system. The reality is that unless those of us who are payers and administrators of these large systems are willing to change and go after some of the administrative barriers that Dr. Schwartz talked about a little while ago, we're not going to be able to change this. We've taken a lot of risks in terms of how we've done this, but I think it takes that kind of courage to push through and challenge some of the status quo around some of these issues.
Mark, tell me what the barriers are. What stops this from being effective? And I know certainly one of the things we talked about was stigma. And I don't know. We have learned more and more about mental illness and learning that it's biological mostly, and stigma really hasn't diminished all that much, has it, or has it?
Right. Well, first of all, I'd say that what we know or most commonly held theories right now is it's a combination of biology, genes, and environment. So it's not just biology. And I'd actually add maybe to Lauren's story is that it sounds like she attributes a lot to the medications, but I hope that she had providers and other people in her life who were providing her with hope and encouragement as well, which is what a recovery-oriented system is all about, providing that hope and encouragement. And I do think that Dr. Evans has really been able to move the conversation forward here in Philadelphia to have hope be part of that conversation, and that everyone in the system is hearing it. And I guess one of the first barriers is that while Dr. Evans has moved the conversation forward, Philadelphia has historically been pretty sophisticated behavioral health system. Got the conversation forward, people are talking about recovery, but one of the concerns is it's not being evenly applied among every provider and every program throughout the city. and I can say this for surrounding counties and statewide, nationally, that one of the barriers to recovery, the development of recovery-oriented systems, is that not all providers buy it, not everybody has the same level of hope. There are providers I'm talking about, and family members who are discouraged, hopeless, don't think that this is possible. So that's one major barrier. Another barrier is this is evidence-based practice. We know that not working is not good for you. We know that poverty is not good for you. We know that I hear from plenty of students, people who have dropped out of college and university, been kicked out, actually, because of a mental illness, and that's not good for you. We know that people aren't participating like everybody else related to having mental illness, and there aren't enough of these services and supports out there, and we're not addressing the barriers that are like stigma, like lack of transportation, that are keeping people from doing those things.
Arthur, just the
just
last
quickly,
few seconds.
I think that Dr. Salsa's comments were right on the money, and one of the biggest barriers is that we have a medical model way of financing our system, so that when people's symptoms go away, so does their funding. They're no longer medically they no longer have medical necessity. And I think one of the biggest challenges we've had is how do we shift dollars to support people so that they don't need to come back into the treatment system, but they get those supports like housing,
and
employment.
And I'm sure
them.
That's just one of very many challenges for you. Let me thank all three of you. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We could go on much longer. Thank you so much. My guests have been Arthur Evans, Director of Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health and Mental Retardation, Mark Salzer, Associate Professor of Psychology at Penn, Principal Investigator of the Collaborative on Community Integration. I've also been joined by Harold Schwartz, Psychiatrist-in-Chief, Vice President of Behavioral Health for the Institute of Living in Connecticut. Next week, we'll be talking about resilience. Well, if you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been James Thomas. Thank you, James. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons. Our intern is Jonathan Glick. Me? I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
You've been enjoying